The Committee on Immigrant and Refugee Rights will now come to order. Today, we have one item on the agenda, which is a subject matter hearing with no votes to be taken.
Andre Vasquez is a member of the Chicago City Council. He's one of 50 people who holds this role.
And oversight of contracted agencies. We'll begin with a roll call to establish quorum.
Aside from the regular day-to-day business of making sure the garbage gets picked up and the potholes are fixed, Vasquez also chairs the City Council's Committee on Immigrant and Refugee Rights.
At this time, we will begin the public comment period.
The committee, Vasquez told me, is there to hold the mayor's office accountable for how the city manages the migrant crisis. As you've likely heard by now, since the middle of 2022, Chicago, along with other Democratic-leaning cities like Denver and New York, has seen the arrival of tens of thousands of asylum seekers, many from Venezuela, with more coming every week, bussed in and flown in primarily by Republican Governor Greg Abbott of Texas.
The period is limited to 30 minutes. Out of respect for everyone's time, each speaker is limited to 3 minutes.
The committee meetings are open to the public, a public with a list of questions and concerns about the migrants flocking to Chicago.
Our first speaker will be Carlos.
Hola.
Yeah, tiene 3 minutos, solo para decirle.
Yeah.
Some speakers are new arrivals.
Chicago es una ciudad, pues, que nos ha ayudado mucho.
Others are there to show their support for the migrants.
This is the time for Chicago to shine and lead by example. We're all humans. We all deserve an opportunity.
But there are also a lot of people who sound frustrated. Frustrated about how all these migrants came to Chicago in the first place. Frustrated about all the resources being spent on these newcomers and not on their own communities.
Standing on the plight of Black people, using our laws, using our issues to get ahead.
Where are you all at when it's time for protecting our neighborhoods? The
things that are Vasquez keeps calm in these meetings, hearing everyone out.
Okay, thank you for that. Just wanted to add to kind of your point about the federal...
Which can be tough when he's called out by name.
So Vasquez, I'm going to need you to get your people. And then you got the nerve...
If you have to pick somebody to chair a committee like that, picking someone who used to be a battle rapper is not the worst decision because you have a thicker skin than most.
That's right. Before becoming a member of Chicago City Council, Vasquez spent many years rapping under the name Prime, battling other rappers in what he estimates were 1,000 duels, where his rivals picked at every chink in his armor.
My experience battle rapping has prepared me for people yelling and screaming at me and insulting me in a way that doesn't rattle me in a way that I think it might any other person. It's the ability to improvise and kind of like find a way to turn a phrase over and find ways to turn the energy around.
As the chair of the Immigration Committee, that ability to keep calm in the face of anger and reproach is good to have right now, because even though Chicago is 1,000 miles from the southern border, it's turning into a new battleground of the migrant crisis. It's a turn of events no one saw coming. After all, Chicago became a sanctuary city more than 3 decades ago, meaning local officials won't ask about a person's immigration status or turn that information over to federal agents. But that welcome is wearing off because of the way these new migrants have arrived. Buses pull up, dropping off groups of migrants that number in the dozens, even in the hundreds, having been sent there courtesy of the state of Texas. And city officials in Chicago have received little previous notice of these drop-offs, and that's caused a lot of chaos as the city has scrambled and often struggled to respond. The pushback hasn't just come during contentious city council meetings, or from just one community. In lots of different neighborhoods, there have been protests about where the shelters to house all these migrants should go.
South Shore neighbors filing a lawsuit trying to block the city of Chicago from moving migrants into the old
South. This mayor is acting like a dictator. He needs to go.
They have to take care of their own constituents, their own people, before they take care of anybody from the outside.
People here say a lack of resources and lack of safety are their main issues with the plan.
When you think about all the things that we allow to slide, this is another thing that, you know, we just can't allow this to happen.
These heated debates playing out in Chicago are happening across America, not just in border states. And that's transforming immigration into the defining issue of the 2024 presidential election. Most voters say immigration is more important to them than anything else, from inflation to crime. And the numbers are staggering. In just 1 month, December of 2023, U.S. border officials dealt with nearly a quarter of a million attempts by people to cross the southern border, a new record. So no doubt this is a problem. But when you listen to pundits and politicians talk about this problem, it only seems to get more confusing.
Republicans, they want chaos on the southern border. They want
fentanyl. Joe Biden now, he wants this border open because
the crime is going to be tremendous.
There is no economic calculation. There is no logical calculation. There is only a political calculation.
Until all you end up with are more questions than answers. This is a complicated issue. So we're going to take two episodes to explore it. And rather than trying to explain the crisis from absolutely every angle, we're going to zoom in on two places that reveal problems playing out on a larger scale. First, Venezuela, a country that's seen a massive outpouring of its population over the past decade. And since 2021, hundreds of thousands of those migrants have showed up at the U.S. border. In fact, by the end of 2023, Venezuelans were one of the leading nationalities trying to illegally enter the U.S. from Mexico. So what's driving them here? And what can Venezuela's decline into abject poverty and violent authoritarianism help us understand about the future of migration to the U.S.? Then in part two, we'll head to Chicago, a sanctuary city that's been strained as it's asked to shelter and feed tens of thousands of Venezuelan migrants, so we can find out what the real local effects of this surge are, not just what the politicians with their megaphones say they are. And how is busing these recent migrants to cities in the Midwest and Northeast from the border states shifted the political discussion around immigrants in this crucial election year? I'm Peter Bergen. Welcome to In the Room. If you want to solve a problem, any problem, it's important first to understand what's causing it. And when it comes to understanding the surge of migrants showing up at the southern border of the United States, there's probably no better case study than Venezuela.
In September, for the first time ever, more Venezuelans came across the border than Mexicans. 54,830 in one...
Migration from Venezuela to the U.S. has skyrocketed in the past 3 years, as people flee a country with a poverty rate over 80%. But poverty alone doesn't explain this mass exodus. Venezuela is a failed state. Human rights abuses, extraordinary levels of violence, and nationwide blackouts can make life unbearable. Some migrants are fleeing the violence, others poverty. But it's often all of the above. So how did Venezuela, with the largest oil reserves in the world, surpassing even Saudi Arabia, get to this point? Well, in that story, one figure matters more than any other. A young, charismatic soldier named Hugo Chavez, who became president in 1999, taking his message of revolution to a working class that was tired of the two corrupt parties that together had ruled the country for decades.
He came to power with a discourse that was very appealing to many who felt excluded from the political system for a very long time.
This is Tamara Tarasiuk-Braner. She's a program director at the Inter-American Dialogue, a U.S.-based think tank. Braner says that Chavez came to power with promises to fight poverty, and the country's tremendous oil wealth allowed him to make good on this pledge.
It was at a time when Venezuela was benefiting from high oil prices and a lot of oil production. And it was with this enormous amount of funds that he was able to fund a lot of his social programs that benefited many, many Venezuelans.
Chavez was wildly popular, and he kept on winning elections.
Chavez appeared at the presidential palace. "The Venezuelan people have spoken," he said, "and the people's voice is the voice of God."
Viva Venezuela!
But his populist charm came with a hunger to consolidate his power, and he quickly moved to weaken the country's institutions so he could rule with impunity.
He was able to politically take over the Supreme Court in 2004. He got a huge majority in Congress, and that allowed him to govern with basically no limits and no checks to what he was doing once in office.
Chavez died of cancer in 2013 after 14 years in power, and his handpicked successor, a former bus driver named Nicolas Maduro, managed to scrape out a win and has held onto power thanks to changes Chavez engineered to the Constitution and the judiciary.
And it is precisely this concentration of power that has allowed the current government of Venezuela to commit all sorts of abuses without any checks on its power.
That's included plenty of state violence against protesters who contested Maduro's regime. Security forces rounded up young people, arrested them, beat them, even tortured and killed them. College students like Gabriel, whose name were changing to protect his identity, took to the streets.
Tear gas bombs raining, and suddenly you couldn't breathe. You start to cry, and then you get blind. In the back of that tear gas cloud, it was a soldier that has orders to capture you and then torture you.
They were not rogue agents that just committed excesses. There were systematic abuses committed by security forces. Electric shocks, brutal beatings.
The military, the soldiers, kill kids around me. We only have a wooden shield and rocks and bottles. And they have rifles, guns, tanks, tear gas. We are like kids that dress up like soldiers, but we weren't soldiers.
Meanwhile, the price of Venezuelan oil collapsed. The welfare program Chavez had founded ran out of money, and it was hard to find basic goods.
Our daily routine is not to go to the gym or the cinema, but to go from one supermarket or shop to another. I go to one and they've got nothing. I go to another and they've got sugar. But there's no cooking oil, no butter, no cereal or flour.
And then there was runaway inflation.
Inflation in Venezuela is the highest in the world, one of the issues that fueled the recent anti-government protests.
And violent crime exploded.
You don't know if you're going to be robbed in the street by a thief or if you're going to be the victim of some corrupt police officer.
Upper-class Venezuelans began to leave shortly after Maduro was elected. People like Gabriel's friends and family who could secure visas bought plane tickets. They started new lives in places like Spain and the United Kingdom.
You ask me why I'm still here, and I really don't know. In every birthday, I made a list of friends to invite and celebrate my birthday. And every year, that list is shorter because every year, a different friend migrates.
In the past few years, even the country's working class, people who'd once benefited from the safety net of Chavez's social programs, found they could no longer get so much as basic medicine or even afford to buy food.
They couldn't survive in Venezuela with their salaries, and they couldn't get enough money to feed their kids.
Starting in 2021, a tidal wave of Venezuelan migration to the U.S. was prompted by a combination of things. COVID travel restrictions were being lifted. Smugglers were opening up new routes. Meanwhile, online chatter suggested that the Biden administration might be more lenient for migrants than the Trump team. That all came after a pandemic year that had devastated economies in Latin America.
People don't migrate just because we live in a violent country, you know? People migrate because we live in a violent country, but we also live in a country that is in economic crisis, in humanitarian crisis, and in a country where human rights are not respected.
As of 2024, one in four Venezuelans are living outside of their country. People like a migrant I'll call Julio, who didn't want us to use his real name. He left Venezuela more than 4 years ago. Julio learned to speak English from his dad.
My first contact was with English and not with Spanish.
His father's family was originally from Trinidad. They passed the English language down between the generations. And he also speaks a little bit of Italian.
Soltanto un po'.
Soltanto.
Lei parla italiano?
Io parlo l'italiano.
Ah,
sì.
Bravo, bravissimo.
Julio once had a middle-class life, working for the Social Security Agency in Venezuela.
I had a very good job. I used to earn 7 times the minimum wage in Venezuela. But when everything started to, you know, going crazy, the salary wasn't enough. There was a point that we were eating only once a day to save food for the children. So the situation was getting worse and worse every day.
Julio thought about leaving Venezuela for a long time.
But the fact that made me took the decision for real, I mean, this is it, I'm done, I'm going to leave my country, is when my wife, oldest daughter, got killed because of a shooting between the forces of law, the government forces of law, and a gang band.
Julio says one of his family members saw the shooting between the police and the gang.
After that, we were threatened. So we decided to move from Venezuela to Colombia.
Like Julio, many of the Venezuelan migrants who are now at the U.S. border first tried living in neighboring Colombia or other Latin American countries like Ecuador and Peru. But those fresh starts got derailed when those countries fell into their own economic depressions that began during the COVID-19 pandemic, and jobs became scarce, even for locals. Julio and his family spent 4 years in Colombia, but he says they were still being threatened by Venezuelan police.
So we decided to put the more distance we can between these people and my family.
In July of 2023, they joined tens of thousands of other Venezuelans making the treacherous journey from Colombia north.
Do you know the jungle? The name of the jungle is Darién, between Colombia and Panama. We crossed walking on foot, my whole family, my 2 kids, my stepsons, my step-grandchildren, okay? A baby of 3 months.
It's hard to overstate how dangerous a trip it is, in that literally it's like walking through a dangerous jungle. So, like, you start there.
Cecilia Munoz is one of the United States' leading experts on immigration. She's also on the board at New America, where I work. And as she says, crossing the Darién Gap is a huge risk. This massive roadless jungle connects Panama and Colombia. Here, migrants wade through rivers, walk for days through downpours, sleep on the jungle floor. Many end up penniless if they survive the journey at all.
I mean, imagine being desperate enough that that is the better option for you and your children than to stay where you are. It is a ferociously dangerous thing people are doing. And they're doing it on the small hope that there will be something for them here.
Until recently, the Darién Gap was considered too treacherous to cross. Back in 2011, the Panamanian government registered fewer than 300 people who'd made the trip. Many Venezuelans used to fly into Mexico, skipping the Darién Gap altogether. But when Mexico changed its visa requirements in 2022, a move intended to stem this flow of migrants, Venezuelans began coming this way instead. Last year, 500,000 people, most of them Venezuelan, made the trip through the Darién Gap. Julio says to get his kids through the journey, he made it out to be like it was an adventure.
You know, mountains, the river, sleeping in tents. So they weren't scared.
But for him, trekking through this dangerous jungle was frightening.
I was afraid to die because I have 46 years. I am still young, but I am not a kid. You got me? So I said, well, if I die here, how they gonna make it after? No, so I have to do this. I have to do it. I can't quit. I have to keep going. I have to move forward for them.
He made it across the Darién Gap, then through Central America and Mexico. And here is where the story gets bumped up to the front pages of American newspapers. Like tens of thousands of other Venezuelan migrants, Julio and his family are applying for asylum, a legal designation that would allow them to stay in the U.S. and eventually apply to be citizens.
So, I mean, in the middle of a process requesting for asylum.
But Julio says that many of his official documents were lost when he and his family were trying to cross a river in the Darien Gap. You'll notice I'm using that phrase a lot, Julio says, because when it comes to these stories of migrants far from home, it's often difficult to verify the details. And that's often a problem for these migrants because in order to get asylum, they need to prove that their stories are true. Can I ask you a sort of basic question? So when somebody claims asylum, what are the legitimate bases for asylum as opposed to, you know, what would get you sent back if your claim was found to be unfounded?
You need a well-founded fear of persecution. So the classic model for people who are like old enough to remember the Soviet Union was somebody who was defecting, who could find their way to the United States and said, my life would be in danger back in my home country.
Fewer than half of the applicants for asylum in the U.S. receive it. It's a system that was created after World War II, when around 400,000 displaced people were resettled in the U.S. Many of them were Holocaust survivors.
Arriving in the USA is the first batch of displaced persons admitted under the annual quota fixed by President Truman. Friends and relatives are at the quayside to greet the survivors of the Hitler terror.
In 1951, the United Nations created its definition of a refugee, a person who can't return to their country owing to well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group, or political opinion. The U.S. eventually enshrined this definition into its laws during the Cold War, and it's what guides judges as they determine whether a migrant like Julio will qualify for asylum or not. Simply fleeing a screwed-up country that's mired in extreme poverty isn't enough to get asylum.
Our asylum law was really built on a kind of a Cold War model. Through court cases and changes in asylum standards over the years, the aperture has broadened, and the things people are fleeing go now beyond communist regimes, which is in some ways what our asylum system was kind of intended for, and are being tested around things like gang and drug violence, domestic violence.
So in countries like El Salvador, where there's a lot of gang violence and you have a well-founded fear that your family could be subject to it.
So ultimately that gets adjudicated, and you can't say definitively whether such a case would make it through, but some do.
One thing that's always striking to me is, I think the number is there are only 650 asylum judges or some. I mean, it's a tiny number. We're a country of 350 million odd people.
We have such a backlogged asylum system that people wait 5 to 10 years to have their hearing. And honestly, the smuggling networks operating in places like Venezuela know this. What they market to people is, give us the money, we'll take you across. And if you just get in, look for the Border Patrol and tell them you want asylum, because then you've got years before anything happens. And that's true.
What Munoz just said gets at one of the most confusing aspects of this issue: how people are coming in and whether that makes them legal or illegal immigrants. It's an idea that comes up everywhere from presidential campaign speeches.
We sent home nearly 1 million illegals during my first term, and we will far surpass that number because we have
to city council meetings in Chicago.
I cannot call them migrants, because see, migrants are people who come through the borders legally, the right way.
Illegals is a term that Andre Vasquez, the Chicago City Council member, hears often.
It brings a level of sorrow to hear folks say, like, well, who are these people?
And he takes issue with the label illegal.
Calling them illegals or illegal aliens. Seeking asylum is a legal process. Folks are here legally. That is absolutely the truth.
Vasquez is right. Asylum is a legal process. Some of the people claiming asylum are making an appointment for an interview with U.S. border officials while they're still in Mexico, where they may wait weeks or months. When the day of their appointment arrives, they come to a U.S. port of entry and are interviewed to see if they have a credible fear of persecution in their country of origin. But not everyone who claims asylum is coming that way. Some people enter into the U.S. illegally, but they're still able to enter into the legal asylum process once they're on U.S. soil. So they may have come here illegally, but they remain here legally. But Munoz says it isn't the right to claim asylum that's causing this crisis at the border. It's the fact that the number of people applying for asylum has risen astronomically, while the process to consider those requests has remained more or less the same.
The asylum system is badly, badly overloaded. The entire system of laws in the United States focused on our border, including our asylum laws, including really the whole policy regime, including also our physical infrastructure, like the buildings that we have at, you know, in border facilities, the personnel and all of their training, all of that was designed for the border we had 30, 40 years ago, where our biggest challenge was individuals coming from Mexico seeking to evade our authorities and work. Our whole infrastructure, legal, physical, personnel, is built for that. And that is not the border that we have now.
We began this journey in Venezuela because tens of thousands of Venezuelan migrants are coming to the U.S. border every month. So how can the U.S. government try to stem the flow of migrants at the source so they don't go on this dangerous journey at all? One American strategy over the past 5 years has been to try to weaken and ultimately change the political leadership of Venezuela by sapping Maduro's government of oil revenues.
A significant escalation. The Trump administration imposing a total economic embargo against the government of Venezuela, intensifying the campaign to remove Nicolas Maduro from office.
These sanctions have succeeded in weakening the Maduro government, but they haven't been enough to topple it. The Biden administration has also tried to use oil sanctions on Venezuela as leverage to compel Maduro's government to allow for fair elections.
The U.S. has been a key actor in the ongoing political negotiations between the Venezuelan opposition and the Venezuelan government because they actually have something to offer, which is lifting these sanctions that are making the Maduro government have less money and less legitimacy in the international markets.
According to the Washington Office on Latin America, U.S. sanctions may have inadvertently spurred more migration because they've intensified the humanitarian crisis that's driving millions to leave Venezuela. They've also made it hard for the international community to do business in Venezuela. That includes charities that have struggled to get food and medicine to people in need. And the U.S. sanctions have also provided the Maduro government with a pretty convenient scapegoat.
What you give the Maduro government is an excuse to blame someone else for the problems for which they only are responsible for.
Even though this crisis is bad for Venezuelans, it's actually benefiting Maduro's government in a bunch of ways. First, migrants who leave send money back to their families, and that's created the illusion of normalcy in certain pockets of the country where people have enough cash to afford the ever-rising cost of living. Second, migration means that many of the people who oppose Maduro have simply left the country. And finally, all those hundreds of thousands of Venezuelan migrants showing up at the U.S. border, they're a valuable bargaining chip for Maduro's government as it tries to get the U.S. to lift its sanctions. For a U.S. audience, this crisis may seem new. It may seem sudden. But for Venezuelans, it's a combination of many factors over decades and across an entire region. Of smugglers promoting a new route through the dangerous Darien Gap, of the COVID pandemic wreaking havoc on a continent, of the daily chaos of living in a failed state where there are gas shortages despite having the world's biggest oil reserves.
Venezuela has been in crisis for a long time. It's not always made headlines. When it's a protracted, constant crisis, it's not as interesting and people just are not concerned about it or don't learn about it as much.
With limited ability to affect the outward flow of migrants from Venezuela, there are of course calls to stop these migrants from coming into the U.S. and from entering an asylum process that often allows them to stay for years while their cases are considered. the Trump administration imposed two policies that made the asylum-seeking process much more difficult. One policy, commonly known as Remain in Mexico, required some asylum seekers to stay on the Mexican side of the border while their claims were considered by U.S. courts. But some groups, like unaccompanied kids, were exempt from this, and it only applied to around 70,000 people over 2.5 years. Trump also applied a health code during the COVID pandemic called Title 42, which Biden also continued until May of 2023, to keep most migrants from being able to claim asylum in the U.S. when they crossed the border illegally. That measure resulted in 2.8 million migrant expulsions from the U.S., although some individuals were expelled multiple times. And it's hard to know how exactly this affected net migration to the U.S., because there's also evidence that getting expelled didn't necessarily deter people from trying to get back in. In fact, according to data collected by U.S. Customs and Border Protection, it may have actually incentivized migrants to evade authorities altogether.
If we learned anything in the Trump years, it should be that there's not a lot that we can do in terms of policy in the United States that deters people from coming. The Trump administration, they did every harsh thing they could think of, and the problem did not abate. And so what we should learn from that as a policy matter is that we can't tough our way out of this problem.
After Julio and his family crossed the southern border, they spent several nights in a tent before border officials took them to a Superlodge motel in El Paso, Texas. Now, they were free to go anywhere in the U.S. as their asylum case wound its way through the legal process. Julio first considered heading to New York City.
But I met a guy who lived here for more than 10 years, and he told me, you know what? New York City is not a good place to raise a family.
Then he thought about Washington, D.C., but was told that it's too expensive.
And my third option was Chicago. So here I am.
Coming up next week, what happens after Julio and his family land in Chicago?
Do you have a winter coat?
No, I don't have winter coat. It is my understanding that this is just the beginning, that it is going to get worse. Is that right?
As city officials scramble to deal with all the newcomers.
We started seeing people sleeping at the police stations, babies, diapers on and no shirt, walking barefoot on a police station floor. At the same time, somebody's being brought in for questioning. Just horribly soul-breaking things you would not have imagined you'd see in the third largest city in the country.
And who's really to blame for the policies that have led to this crisis?
If we had a rational Congress and a real policy debate, we could figure this out.
And what will happen next as Chicago's debate over the fate of migrants reaches a fever pitch?
I saw nothing in the presentation about how much money we're spending. That slide, I guess, got lost. Y'all wasting our time. I got stuff in my community I need to do.
That's next week on In the Room. If you'd like to learn some more about some of the issues discussed in this episode, we recommend Everyone Who Is Gone Is Here, The United States, Central America, and the Making of a Crisis by Jonathan Blitzer. We also recommend Border Wars, Inside Trump's Assault on Immigration by Julie Hirschfield Davis and Michael D. Scheer. Both of those are available on Audible. We've been nominated for a Webby Award. We'd love it if you would take a moment to vote for us. Click on the link in the description of this episode. It just takes 2 clicks to vote. In the Room with Peter Bergen is an Audible original, produced by Audible Studios and Fresh Produce Media. This episode was produced by Laura Tillman and Alexandra Salomon, with help from Luke Cregan. It was sound designed by Stephen Jackson. Our executive producer is Allison Craiglow. Katie McMurrin is our technical director. Our staff also includes Eric German, Holly DeMuth, Nathan Ray, Sandy Malera, and JP Swenson. Our theme music is by Joel Picard. Our executive producers for Fresh Produce Media are Colin Moore and Jason Ross. Our head of development is Julian Ambler. Our head of production is Eleanor Bavietz. Maureen Trainer is our head of operations. Our production manager is Herminio Ochoa. Our production coordinator is Henry Koch. And our delivery coordinator is Anna Paula Martinez. Audible's chief content officer is Rachel Giazza. Head of content acquisition and development and partnerships, Pat Shah. Audible executive producer, Lara Regan Kleinschmidt. Special thanks to Marlon Calbi, Allison Weber, and Vanessa Harris. Copyright 2024 by Audible Originals, LLC. Sound recording copyright 2024 by Audible Originals, LLC.